This is New York firefighter Raphael Poirier. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase.
Your source for the story, science, and strategy of suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and resilience where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I'm so grateful you are here. I have a very special guest today, someone maybe a little bit new to the suicide prevention community that I'm thrilled to connect with. Sebastian Sloven will be joining us from San Diego in just a little bit, and I've just recently got connected to his work, and I was so inspired. I thought, I really want to get him onto the podcast to help connect him to the many audiences that I know will be supported by his work. And the topic of today is really about men and suicide grief. And so we're highlighting this in a time where we're really focused on the bereaved, the people who've been left behind by suicide. And in working in this area over the last few years with my colleagues like Franklin Cook and others, we really realized there is a huge gap that needs to be filled here. Many of the resources that we put forward for support for suicide grief have been developed by, led by, and are filled with women, the mothers, the sisters, the daughters, the aunties, the women that have been bereaved by suicide, and there are fewer resources for the men. And so this led Franklin and I to put together some research back a couple of years ago. So later in the podcast, I'll be sharing a little bit about our findings from that research. But it also is just, it rang true in my own story. Many of you know I lost my brother to suicide in 2004, right around the holidays, December 7th. And so we, our family was just desperate for any kind of guidance on how we were going to live through this crisis. And so we stumbled upon a support group specifically for families. Actually, it was specifically for parents who had survived a suicide loss, but they let me in. And I remember clearly going into that room. There were probably 25, 30 people sitting around, in this church basement. And they went around and introduced themselves. And some of them had been there for years, which was unimaginable to me at the moment. But I get it now. They stay on to be mentors to the new people. And they were just going around introducing themselves and their loss and you know, the thoughts that they were having that day. And so it took up a good chunk of our hour and a half meeting to go around this huge table. And my family was sitting at the tail end of going around, and I could barely get any words out. We were all so close to our grief at that point in time. It was very hard to talk. And same with the rest of my family members. We were barely able to mutter a couple of words. And we walked out of that experience. It was, you know, my parents and other family members. And, you know, my mom and I were like, that was so powerful. That was so incredible to be connected to other people who've gone through this, who were before us, and gave us hope that maybe we could. But there was a male member of my family who was like, that was way too overwhelming. That was not helpful to me. And it was just striking about how different our takeaway experiences were. And I'm not saying that we had men in the group that it was very helpful for, but it dawned on me that, you know, grief support is not a one size fit all. and that we probably need to be thinking through a little bit more strategically on what we need to do to support men who, like, a support group is not the thing that's going to be helpful for them. So that's what emerged out of that research, is really a gap analysis. The other thing that was really helpful for me in kind of these early days and kind of thinking this through was a book that I really recommend for the men that are in this state currently of bereavement by suicide, and that's Thomas Gordon's book called Swallowed by a Snake, The Gift of the Masculine Side of Healing and a man You Know is Grieving, 12 Ideas for Helping Him Heal from Loss. This was the first book and possibly the only book of the time that really focused on men's grieving experience. And he talks about, you know, I always say it's overlapping bell-shaped curves. Whenever we look at gender differences, there's a lot of similarities that happen in the middle, but there are, in many things that we do, there are some differences that happen on the fringes and in the majority. So he came to the conclusion that that men's process of grieving tends to be what he called unconscious grieving. So it's kind of percolating in the background, and that sometimes it comes to the forefront in unexpected ways, and that potentially, you know, if we found some ways that we could release, he called the pressure releases of the grief through rituals or through peer support, and really positioning those experiences as forms of strength and transformation and growth and healing, we could do a lot to help men not feel so isolated in their grief response. And he says, I quote, gender differences exist in the grief response and need to be honored. And there's a lot the genders can learn from one another. So anyway, I found his work really helpful. Again, Thomas Gordon, Swallowed by a Snake is the name of the book. So today we are joined by Sebastian Slovin from San Diego, and his book is called Ashes in the Ocean, A Son's Story of Living Through and Learning from His Father's Suicide. And like I said, his publicist reached out. I went to the website and I watched the video trailer of the promotion for the book, and I was brought to tears. It was so powerful. I mean, Sebastian was a very, very young child when his father died, and his father, we'll hear much more of this, Vernon, was really a legend in his home country, kind of had this really exceptional life. And when you look at the life, you're like, wow, you know, that's a magical person that had all of these opportunities. He was a legendary swimmer, just a really popular figure in the culture. And then it all came crumbling down, and Sebastian grew up in the shadow of his father's suicide. And so you'll hear a lot more about Sebastian's story today. Currently, in addition to being an author, Sebastian's also a speaker. He got his master's degree in leadership studies from the University of San Diego. And so he speaks not only on this topic and really very authentically and from the heart, but he also is a nature adventurer. And I'm sure that's been a big part of his healing, kind of connecting to nature, especially the ocean. And what that has meant to him. I'm sure we'll hear more about that. He also provides coaching services to help others put together plans and activities and mindsets around their well-being, their mental health, and their leadership. So this is a great package of not only grief support information that we'll hear today, but also kind of life direction support. So with that, I'll introduce my new friend, Sebastian Slovin. Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sally. I appreciate you having me.
Great. Well, like I said, we're new to each other, so I'm going to be learning a lot today about your story and the lessons that you've learned. Why don't you start with us wherever you want about kind of what is the path that led you here today?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you did. That was such an amazing intro to my dad. I was, you know, just it resonated with me, and so I appreciate that. And I'll share a little bit about my journey and kind of how I got here. And you know, really, my as you mentioned, my dad was this, you know, legendary character, larger than life character, South African native, but eventually made his way out to the States on a swimming scholarship, and then came out to San Diego And yeah, had basically, from my perspective, was this, you know, heroic figure. And I think that's from the outside looking in, it looked like he had it all. And then out of the blue, to me at least, he took his own life when I was 6 years old. So it's been a little while. It was in 1990. And everything after that changed pretty dramatically, as you can imagine. And, you know, family dynamic changed. And not only was my dad not around, but my mom she did a tremendous job of stepping up and working multiple jobs to provide for us. We were left in a pretty bad financial position when my dad passed away.
Sebastian, yeah. Would you just go back in time for us a little bit? I mean, you know, my children were very young when my brother died. They were six, 4 and 3 months. And, you know, I've just watched them kind of make sense out of this. But they were actually in the car with me when we learned of my brother's death. And so it was, you know, trying to manage my own grief, but also trying to be cognizant of, I got these really little people who don't even have a concept of what death means, really, let alone suicide. And so I'm just wondering, can you walk us through what your experience was in that moment when you were a child, what happened, what it meant to you, how you understood it, how you learned about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that's, I can only imagine, that's very tough to hear that news with your kiddos there. That's and my experience was that I knew, so my dad was away at the time, but we were living in San Diego. My mom, sister, and I, we were in La Jolla. And there's kind of some backstory to this where I can fill in later, but we had been living in Australia. We immigrated there and then we eventually moved back to San Diego. And then not long after being in San Diego, again, my dad wanted to kind of start anew. And my mom sort of put her foot down, was like, there needs to be more stability for the kids. So she stayed. My dad went back to Australia. So he was away. He had been away for several weeks. And I remember coming home from school one day and my mom took me out into the backyard, and the memories are a little hazy of this, but I remember very clearly sitting on the grass with her in our backyard. And she said, you know, dad had died, and she did say that he took his own life. And I didn't really have a clue what that meant, or didn't really conceptualize that. But I just remember kind of feeling my body go numb, and just, I had no response. I didn't cry. I didn't really do anything, just sort of stared at the grass. And I think that was my, at least for those early years, my survival tactic was just to kind of, so overwhelmed and confused that I just did what I could to not feel. And that meant a lot of isolating. You know, I didn't outwardly sort of express grief or anger or anything. I just kind of kept it all in and tried just not to feel.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to do what you got to do to get through your day, to get through school. And it's such a difficult thing to comprehend or to integrate into the life, your life. And you had a sibling. Was your sibling older or younger?
Yeah. I have a younger sister. So she was, I was six. She was two at the time. So, you know, obviously totally different dynamic where she has, you know, kind of like, you know, very little memory or like flashes of memory of him being around. And it's interesting. I heard later, when speaking to my mom and other people, I guess my sister was really kind of outwardly expressing her emotion, you know, like kind of throwing these tantrums. And that was, I guess at the time my mom had a friend who was a psychotherapist and was like, this, you know, this is good. We'll, you know, want to see this emotion being released. And I was sort of the opposite, kind of just more isolating and closing off.
Wow. And then what happened? I mean, because I know, like, watching my, my brother's children grow up and other kids who've lost parents grow up, I mean, there's things, you know, you do crafts around Father's Day in elementary school and, you know, all of these other reminders of this loss in the family. How did that play out for you in those early years?
Yeah, I think very similar to that. I think I kind of held it together for the most part and then would just have these breakdowns. kind of like, you know, just someone who would mention their father or a friend who would mention their father or, you know, Father's Day or things like that. And I just sort of lose it, you know, kind of either. And this is as I got a little bit older, you know, I'd have these sort of kind of crying fits or outbursts of sort of anger and all that stuff. And it was, I did my best to keep it all together at all times and like look like nothing bothered me. And I think this got worse and worse as I got a little older and could, you know, in my early teens and could more fully comprehend what suicide was, you know, and could feel this and, you know, feel and, be aware of the stigma around it. You know, I'd notice it, you know, for some reason when my dad's name comes up and, you know, extended family gatherings, the topic has changed really quickly. Or if, you know, suicide no one ever said suicide in our household. You know, we never talked about it. It was like this, okay, let's just, I think for my mom, she was kind of thrust in the survival mode place, you know, kind of more backstory, but like, as I mentioned, we were in a bad financial place. So we moved and she was kind of just doing what she could to provide for us. And she was away and, you know, so everyone was just kind of in survival mode for a long time. And so we didn't talk about it. We didn't really deal with it. And I realized that culturally it wasn't okay to talk about. And so that kind of reinforced not only me not talking about it or dealing with it, but it made me feel, I'm sure this is a common thing, that there was something wrong with me by association.
Yep.
To my dad's death. And that sort of, that grew on, weighed on me significantly, especially as I got into my teens.
So you have this early childhood of kind of just really stuffing or surviving and isolating and just getting through. And then in the teen years, there's an awakening of sorts, both in the feeling and the acknowledgement, like this happened and no one's talking about it. And then also feeling like maybe there's something wrong with me as well because I'm connected to this story, this experience. Was there a turning point for you? And when did that happen where you kind of just, you know, worked into the space of, you know, not only claiming this part of your life, but then also talking about it publicly to help others? Was there a moment in time where you had a realization that, you know, this is what needs to happen?
There was, yeah, and I'd like to just hold up, just really quickly go back and just share one more thing that I think is important in the rest of the thread is that, I forgot to mention this, but I think something that really saved my life in the early years, was my connection to the ocean. As you sort of mentioned in the intro, my dad was this awesome swimmer. A lot of my memories of him are in and around the ocean, you know, grew up right by the ocean there in La Jolla. And when he died, he was cremated. We spread his ashes in the ocean at this place called La Jolla Cove, which is a pretty iconic beach in San Diego. And after that, you know, no matter how bad things got for me on land, if I could, you know, the ocean was my refuge. If I could just get to the beach or to the water, you know, my time there, I viewed that environment like it was sort of an extension of my dad or my time to be with him. And so it saved me in a lot of ways, but for many years, it didn't really transfer over into the rest of my life. It was like this safe space, kind of I felt like my true home was out there. And, but I think that got me through a lot of the difficult times in my teenage years. So, and in my teens, I got really into bodyboarding, which is, yeah, in Colorado, I don't know if you're familiar, it's like boogie boarding is the same thing, if you're familiar with that.
Yep.
Yeah. So
probably
I
not on the level that you appreciate it, but I have a general sense of what it's all about.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Sort of like surfing, but, you know, smaller board, using flippers on your feet. Anyway, I got really into that and had the opportunity. I started competing in high school and then had the opportunity to compete and eventually go pro after high school. But toward the end of my high school career, my senior year, this is getting back to the turning point question. I had the opportunity to go to Australia, and the trip was an opportunity for me to go bodyboarding some great waves out in Australia and also to connect with some family friends who lived out there. And as I mentioned, my dad died by suicide. It was in Perth, Australia, which is west coast of Australia.
Yeah.
And at the time, he was very close. He had some really close family friends who we stayed in touch with after he passed away, and I was scheduled to stay with them. And there were a guy named John David and his wife Sarah. They're South Africans as well. John David grew up with my father. They swam together, competed against each other, had stayed close friends even though they lived in different parts of the world. And I was super thrilled to go to Australia for the opportunity to travel and to surf, but I was terrified because I hadn't really talked about my dad's death, and I just, you know, I knew that going there was going to, this was going to be a main topic, because I was going to where he died. I was going to be with some friends who knew him well and were around at the time, or close to the time of his death. So I arrive, and the first day I'm there, John David invites me to go on this walk around the neighborhood. And they live in this beautiful neighborhood by this river. It's really, really beautiful. And we're out, and again, I'm excited, but I'm nervous. And he kind of, you know, we have a few minutes of just a general conversation, and then he just dives right into talking about my dad. And I'm like just terrified. And he shared, you know, how incredible he was, my dad was, and how difficult his death was on, you know, on the family, and yeah, how he could only imagine what it was like for us, and just, you know, kind of shared his thoughts.
This is like
on,
12 years, right? 12 or more years after the death.
Yeah, this is So I was 17 at the time, so it was about 11 years after.
Yeah, 11 years, and this is really the first real deep conversation that you've had at that point.
Yeah, correct. I had little flashes of, you know, like putting my foot in, you know, dipping my toes in, that kind of thing with the conversation, but not a full on.
Yeah, remarkable. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he shares, and I'm not talking, I'm just sort of listening and sort of uptight, and he goes on to share that his father, so John David's father, took his own life when he was a kid. I think he was like 11 years old, and this really traumatic scene. And he tells me what happened, and he shares with me what his experience was like after that. And it was, you know, pretty much exactly like what I had been living, you know, not talking about it, the stigma in his, you know, he grew up in a kind of a suburb of Johannesburg, and, you know, no one talked about it. And his family was, you know, there was a mark on their family, you know, it was the major shame, major stigma. And after he shared about it, his experience, I felt not only like I could talk about it, but I wanted to talk about it. Here's someone who had been through, you know, what I was going through. And I didn't know anyone who had come out the other side. And I opened up to John David, and it was this incredibly cathartic experience for me to share and, you know, talk about all these things that I had been holding on to for so long. And we ended up having this remarkable conversation, and in the end he sort of challenged me a little bit. He was, you know, he's like, you know, step into this, you know, you can't run away from this, and I bet if you turn to face this, there's some stuff you can learn from this. And so it kind of encouraged me to go out and you know, I guess it was a planted the seed for me to go out and start the conversation or have more of these conversations.
Wow. Yeah, I often say, like, there are these angels that drop into our lives sometimes, you know, and say the thing that we need to hear to take us into our next chapter. And that sounds like that's what that was for you, just a very transformative conversation to let you know that you weren't alone. And I love the, you know, you can't run away from it, so maybe step into it and learn from it. It's a very poignant picture, still a very young person, you know, at this point, you know, trying to sort this all out, and as you're becoming a man yourself in that time period of, you know, what does this mean to me, and how do I make sense of it? So what happened
right.
next?
Yeah. So, I mean, after that, I literally on the way home from that trip, long flight back to California, and I made a list of, you know, anyone that I knew who could be a good resource for me to learn more. I guess my mission was to learn more about my dad, like who he was as a person, not just the good things, but also kind of the shadow side, and to get as much information as I could about what, you know, who he was and why he did this or why this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I listed you know, family, friends, people that he grew up with, people that he worked with, you know, all sorts of people. And it's funny, I was going to go through this list, check it off, kind of like a to-do list, and was enthusiastic. And then I realized when I got home that I had forgotten probably one of the main resources on there, which was my mom. I didn't list mm-hmm. my mom for some reason. And then I realized this is going to be very, very scary and very challenging, I think, especially, you know, bringing this conversation up with my mom, who I hadn't really had this conversation at this point. So I kind of went through and set up meetings when I could, or calls. And I think with each conversation, I gathered more information. It was like my own little research project. And it was, these were often full, you know, I cried a lot. I got angry a lot. And it was, I think, my learning how to feel again. And this was kind of a slow process over a few years, where I was kind of made it a point to have these conversations and seek these people out, including my mom, which was, you know, really amazing and very challenging at the same time.
Yeah, I did something similar after Carson died. Because we had been a little bit estranged just the last summer of his life, because it was just very difficult. He was very manic and agitated, and it was just hard. And so I felt like I had missed this really important part of his life, and I went back and interviewed his friends, and, you know, there was just part of me that I just needed to put the pieces together. I needed to understand the pieces that I didn't know, and kind of what was going on for him that led to that moment. So I do think that for many of us, there is that drive to, I have a colleague who calls it the canyon of why, Frank Campbell. You know, we just kind of dig around and go, what happened, and try to form a narrative that makes some kind of sense to us. And not everybody who does the same kind of interviewing actually comes to the same kind of conclusion around those narratives.
Right.
But I think it's an important part of our healing process to try to piece it together. So what was that like for you? And how did that work out with your mom?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very difficult, as I said, kind of just learning how to feel again. I think that was kind of the main thing. And it was really, I think, extraordinary in terms of I started to come away with these general themes, and this is specific to my dad, but I think I mentioned this in my teens, and especially in my later teens, I was feeling more and more like I didn't really have a choice in the matter, like I was destined to follow in my dad's footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about suicide a lot, I think, you know, I think the only thing that kept me around, you know, the ocean, and then I just couldn't bear to put my mom or sister through that. And it was something that was constantly on my mind, and I felt like I didn't really have a choice in the matter. And I think when I set out on that journey to talk to different people and figure out the why, it was like initially to avoid going down that same path. And
mm-hmm.
and what I came away with was some really, I think, incredible lessons to, you know, not only help me sort of avoid that, you know, preventative, but really to live well. Lessons on how to live well from, and again, this is specific to my dad's deal, but it was pretty incredible.
That is incredible. And were you already doing the work of kind of your well-being and adventure, nature adventure stuff? Was that also kind of emerging as a parallel thing, or did the investigation around your dad's story lead to that?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I think it was a parallel process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these are some general themes, but, you know, some things that I came away with after talking to people with about my dad was he was really, really highly driven, extremely motivated, high achiever, and was almost like, goal oriented to the extreme. Like he would set a goal, you know, charge forward, get there, set another goal, charge forward, get there. You know, it was like he took what worked well for him in competitive swimming and applied that to life. And it was a reminder to me to, you know, obviously you got to set goals and do those things, but to appreciate the process and, you know, take time to breathe and, you know, basically got me into mindfulness type practices, yoga and things like that. So as I was learning about my dad, and it wasn't entirely, you know, doing the opposite of what he did. He had some really wonderful qualities, but there was a lot of things like, you know, here's some takeaways from this. And that led me to a lot of the, you know, mindfulness practices. And I was, I think, already quite connected to nature. And so my love for that kind of just continued to grow as I went on this journey.
That's great. I mean, I do think there is a huge liability in our achievement-oriented culture that when you define yourself by, you know, how much money you make or how many goals you've crushed or whatever, it's tenuous because those goalposts keep moving. And once you got there, there's always a bigger one down the way. And if by chance you stumble and fall, then who are you? I think the way you put it, like, yes, we need goals, we need to stretch ourselves, we need to be striving towards things, but also those things, those achievements, whatever they are that's important to us, they don't define us. It's just how we're pushing ourselves to grow. What really defines us is how we're living now. So I love that you kind of came into that conclusion, you know, through your own exploration as a fairly young person. To have that kind of insight is awesome. So I'm really grateful that you have also put this book together as a resource to share with other people. Can you talk a little bit about what led you to the book and kind of what your process was in writing it?
Sure. So, you know, I think, you know, ever since this, you know, I never stopped this journey of kind of seeking out people to learn about my dad, but that, I think that sense of putting the pieces back together sort of came to a natural conclusion. And I had this really, for a long time, this sense, like, I want to share this story with other people. And I, probably about 8 years ago, I attempted to start writing it, and then would become, when I really dug into it, I'd become pretty overwhelmed and stop. And so there were a lot, in terms of the writing process, there was a lot of start and stops. And then I've stayed connected with that guy, John David Kennedy, and his family out in Australia. And I think going back to that, that was my, I think, has been one of my strongest motivators for completing the book and putting it out there. The goal to, or the intention to do for other people what John David did for me, which is start the conversation and, you know, go first and then kind of allow for other folks to share and reciprocate. And so a couple of years ago, I got serious about it. I'm like, it's been too many start and stops. And it was actually during my master's program where I was already kind of had the structure and was doing a lot of writing. And so, you know, I was like, let's do a book on top of the master's program. and it ended up working out a lot of writing, a lot of computer time. But yeah, probably a year and a half or 2 years of more solid writing and editing, and then, yeah, just put it out there in April of this year.
Well, congratulations. I know that's a huge accomplishment, and I totally, totally resonate with the start and stop thing. I've got two on my computer right now. I'm like, they are getting off my computer one way or another by the end of this summer. They're going to be done. I say that out loud. If I say it out loud enough times, it will really happen. One of them is very close, and it's a men's anthology. So when that one's done, I will share it with you to get your feedback. Let me
just for a second
here on the research that I mentioned at the top of the podcast that Franklin Cook and I worked on back in 2013, 2014. We actually never formally published the results, which is a shame. And so my conversation with you had led me to dig out our presentation slides that we presented at the American Association of Suicidology in 2014. And now I'm also going to commit out loud that I've already reached out to Franklin. We're going to get this out into the world because I think it's really helpful, and there's really just not enough out there to get this going. So we set out a survey back in 2013, specifically asking men who had been bereaved by suicide to take us on a journey with them about their thoughts on what worked and what didn't work and what they needed and what was helpful and not helpful, and just to kind of figure out where the gaps were and what ideas might be helpful in moving forward. And I always like to bring, you know, whatever science, whatever research we have to these conversations, because I think that there's tremendous power in the lived experience story. There's also power in what science is telling us is happening. And then if we can combine all these forms of expertise, we can really create some helpful takeaways. So that's my intention here. So in this study, we had just a little under 200 participants, all the way from 19 to 70 years old, but about 58% of them were over 50. So it was an older section of demographics, and they were also 93% white, so very predominantly a white population and about 90% straight. So most of these were adult men who had lost They had lost fathers, they had lost sons, they had lost brothers. And we asked them a number of questions. I'm not going to go through the whole study, but we asked them, how much did grief affect your life, from not at all to a tremendous amount? And on all measures of well-being, they were very high. So mood was the highest, economic well-being was the lowest, physical health, spiritual health, social relationships, and outlook for the future were all about the same at very high levels, you know, between 7 and 9 for these guys. And then we asked them, how long did it take for you to feel like your grief was no longer a constant difficulty in your life? And some of our guys were actually filling the survey out pretty close to the death, so they were just very much in the throes of that chaotic time of what just happened. So that this was not an appropriate question for them. But for the guys who were, you know, well on in their decades out from their loss, you know, they talked about it being anything from, you know, 1 to 10 years or more, to have any kind of sense where this wasn't, like you were mentioning, like a constant thing on their mind, a constant experience that they were going through. We asked them what kind of supports were helpful, and similar to what you had indicated, friends and family were indicated as the most helpful, and then really more face-to-face types of things. So face-to-face individual help with peers, or formal support services that were face-to-face in small groups. They weren't as inclined to do any other kind of more formal support services. It tended to be more informal. And then I'll just wrap up with one other set of findings, which is we asked them about potential differences that they perceived between men and women around grief experiences. And 81% of our guys said that men and women grieved differently to some degree. For some, it was quite a bit, and for others, it was a lot. And that, you know, over half felt that men should have special programs or special opportunities to deal with their grief that maybe aligns them with male peer supports, either one-on-one or in a group. And almost all of them said that they would be, you know, especially the ones that were farther from their loss, said that they would be willing to help other men bereaved by suicide. And so I go back to that conversation, you know, that you had with your father's friend. And sometimes it just takes one other person, and in this case, you know, potentially another male, to open the door and say, you know, I've gone through something similar, you know, I'm here to listen. That can really help move people forward from that unconscious grieving that Thomas Gordon talks about, to kind of being able to recognize what it was in your life and integrate it back into your life's narrative in a more meaningful way. Any thoughts about any of that I just shared?
Yeah, I certainly appreciate you sharing that stuff. I think, you know, it's I'm, you know, as you mentioned, I'm kind of sort of, as I just launched the book, I'm, you know, did research, but I'm early on in my sort of more formal learning about the formal research. It totally resonates with me and my experience. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm thinking about my teenage years and high school years. I think, you know, I had maybe one conversation. I think maybe my best friend, I had one conversation, a brief conversation about my dad, where I told him the truth. Everyone else, I said, you know, who asked about my dad, I said he died in a car accident, or I just say something different, you know. In the years after, when I kind of started talking about it and exploring it, I kind of circled back to some of my more childhood friends, high school friends, and it was incredible how many of them were also touched by had lost a loved one or family member by suicide, or knew someone who was dealing with, you know, mental health issues, you know, just opening up the conversation around suicide and mental health. It was incredible. Once I started to have those conversations, how many people had something going on. And I was like, what a shame as a young person to not have that camaraderie, those resources out of the fear of being judged, or, you know, the stigma, which is, I think, what this is all about, is, you know, how to lessen that.
Yeah. So having walked through this now in your own experience, but also now with others, do you have some suggestions for men in particular who may be grieving a suicide loss of a close person, a friend, a family member, a father, a brother, a son? What are some of the lessons that you've learned? What are some of your takeaways?
Yeah, I think you're doing a tremendous job with your show and with your work on doing the work to support men. So I just want to say I really, really appreciate it, and it's awesome work. And I think, you know, I'm aligned, you know, on a lot of stuff. I think maybe pretty simple advice, but you know, I think about just not the times when I was not feeling it, or, you know, trying to avoid or isolate. Just clearly does not work. So, you know, in whatever capacity you can, to turn and to feel what's happening. And just, I think, at least for me, I didn't really have the permission to, you know, get angry, or I didn't feel like I had the permission for myself to get angry or to cry. And just, it's okay to feel whatever's coming up. And so I'd say, you know, feel it, and then, you know, process that in, you know, whatever way that you can. It could be different for different people, but I think talking to a friend, you know, family member, you know, someone you trust, you know, a peer, that I think that's huge. If you feel comfortable, obviously professional support is a wonderful resource. But I think before that, just feeling it and, you know, connecting with someone that you trust. And I think that would be my big takeaway.
Yeah, that's really important. And I love your emphasis on the permission giving. And I think we can do that with ourselves. And I also think we can do that with each other, that it's okay. You know, that feelings are there for a reason. They are signals that we're going through something important. And when we suppress them, we don't learn the lessons that they're trying to share with us. And usually the grief response is really the mirror of love, right? So we don't grieve things that we don't love. And so appreciating that while it's intense and it's overwhelming and it's sad and it's frustrating and angering and all kinds of conflictual kinds of experiences, it comes out of a place of love and honor. And I think that was a really helpful reframe for me, because those, especially those early days, months, I felt like I was never going to get up for air, going to your ocean metaphor. I just never felt I was going to surface again. Just felt like this huge, heavy, wet blanket. To reframe it as you're in this space because you loved him so, just helped me kind of reframe it and put it in a different spot. The other piece of advice that you just gave around talking to a peer or professional support is something else I want to add to. And I just want to get your thoughts on this. So, in both the men's grief by suicide research that we did with Franklin Cook, as well as the men's anthology that I'm working on right now with Frank King and Sarah Geer, and about 40 guys who are sharing various testimonials of coming through difficult times, a very consistent theme has been about connections to faith and spirituality and faith communities as part of their healing. And I don't know, I haven't read your book, so I don't know what your perspective is on all this, but I'm just wondering if you or the other folks that you've talked to have had that as also being part of their kind of healing pathway.
Yeah, I think that is really important to find. And to me, in my experience, it's been nature. And, you know, having that feeling of, you know, I'm pretty small in the whole scheme of things, and I'm also interconnected to all of this. And so that was, I guess, my form of, higher power or yeah, something that was very solid that I could come back to again and again. And I think, yeah, I think, you know, it's just having, you know, whatever that is for you, I think is the important,
right,
important piece, but having some aspect of that, some connection to that. But, and I think that reminds me, you know, another thing just along the same line is that the reminder to people out there who are grieving, that you're not alone in this process. And, you know, I felt like I was the only person in the world who was dealing with this. And obviously it's just not the case. And there's many people touched by suicide loss and all this. So I think a helpful reminder. I know we kind of understand that maybe intellectually, but
yeah,
the feeling of it,
yes,
is different.
The other resource that I wanted to share, that I just shared with you, and I'm hoping the two of you connect, is Chris Michael's Fatherless by Suicide, fatherlessbysuicide.org, where he has pulled together stories of men who've lost their fathers, and how they, you know, as you have, grew up in the shadow of suicide and how they coped with that and through it. A really powerful resource, I think, especially for men who've lost fathers, but I think for many men just dealing with this suicide grief piece in particular, just hearing men's voices, hearing men's stories talk about this, really does drive home this point that you're not alone, that there are other people who found their way, you know, maybe not through it entirely, but they are living with it. They're living with it and living. And they are finding other ways to integrate it into their personal story, but also ways to grow from it and even learn from it in a different way. So that,
yeah,
message of you're not alone is a powerful one. And it's harder. I think it's harder for men because, you know, when I show up to these survivors of suicide loss events at our national conference, all the grieving events on International Survivors of Suicide Loss Day, which is always the third Saturday or the Saturday before Thanksgiving, I should say, in the research, it's predominantly women that are showing up in these spaces. And so it's harder for men to find those connections with one another and to hear the stories that really resonate a little bit more with their own experience. So again, thank you so much for sharing your story, for the book that becomes a real tangible resource for folks. What are the next steps for you?
Yeah, the next steps for me are getting out, continuing to speak on this topic. So, you know, again, spreading the word, sharing. I completely resonated with that and the importance of sharing the story and the narrative behind these things. I think that obviously the science is critical, and then having the story component too, I think, go hand in hand together. So I'm going to be getting out and you know, doing more speaking, you know, wherever I can, schools, you know, mental health communities, universities, things like places like that. And then I also am doing a lot of work. You know, I have a company I founded with my co-founder with my wife called Nature Unplugged, which you touched upon.
Mm-hmm.
Which, so we offer, you know, we do workshops and coaching, and the focus of that is you know, healthier relationships with technology and helping folks get reconnected with nature. And it's not specific to, you know, mental health necessarily. I would consider it like upstream work. Is that the term? You know, like more,
yeah,
preventative side. So, yeah. So just, you know, general wellness and with the sort of view of relationships with tech in this increasingly tech heavy world that we live in.
And as you say that, I'm wondering if I could just plant a seed for you that maybe someday you can also do that for the downstream, by creating maybe retreats for men or even, you know, just a workshop for men grieving suicide who can also connect with one another and nature as part of their healing. I think of, so when Carson died, I was working at Regis University, which is a Jesuit Catholic school here in Denver. And it was a few years later, actually, that we went on a silent retreat up in the mountains. And I just remember like sitting, you know, by the stream weeping about all of the transitions that had happened after his death, but, you know, it just meant a lot. You just get in touch, as you know, you get in touch with yourself when you create that stillness and connect to the larger things in your world, like the ocean and the mountains and the woods and the streams and insights come to you in those spaces that don't come when we're rushing around on our phones and in our commutes and in our jobs. So anyway, I'm just going to plant that seed right there. And
yeah.
Say, wouldn't that be great if Sebastian could do something like that? I think it would be helpful for a lot of folks.
Yeah, I appreciate you planting the seed, and I will cultivate the soil and the garden and all that. get it going.
Sounds good. All right, well, let me just kind of recap a little bit of some of the themes of our conversation, and then I'll come back to you with anything that you want to close with, any kind of final thoughts that you want to leave our listeners with, and then we'll go from there. So we really started off our conversation today about, what it felt like for you to learn this devastating news as a child so young as six, and how that really is for many of us throughout the lifespan, that moment of just going into survival mode and doing what you need to do just to get by, just to survive. And for many people, that does mean, pushing these overwhelming feelings down just to kind of get through the day. But they percolate up, as you say. You can't run away from it. Eventually, they'll percolate up. And so the attempts to isolate and suppress will eventually not hold. And then in your teen years, as you started to have those feelings, you also noticed the stigma in yourself and in the people around you that, oh, my gosh, this huge catastrophic thing happened, and nobody is talking about it. So therefore, the logical mind goes, there must be something wrong. There must be something wrong with what happened. There must be something wrong with me. So probably best not to talk about it. But at the same time, these emotions are surfacing. And then I loved your story about, meeting your father's friend and really the importance overall about that safe space, that connection that you have to the ocean and by extension, to your father's friends who are also connected to the ocean, and that real important conversation, how anxious you were in that moment to start the conversation, but how transformative it was 11 years later to open that door, to realize you weren't alone, and also to have a role model older than you who said, it's going to be okay, you're going to live through it. This does not define you. It's a part of your story. It's a part of your history, but you can do things differently. You can't run away from it, so let's step into it and understand it. I love that quote. And then the next stage was really about piecing this narrative together, going back into the history, connecting with the friends and family who could help you understand what happened. I think a lot of us do that to just try to make sense of something that just doesn't make sense. And in that process, you learned lessons on living well, which is what we could only hope for someone who goes into that canyon of why, is that they come out with a deeper appreciation of what their life is all about. And then for the takeaways, this is feeling work. This is feeling work. So let's give ourselves and each other permission to feel all the feels, to the anger, the crying, the desperation, the what ifs. When we acknowledge them, we can process them. When we don't acknowledge them, they just keep knocking on our door, and they will for an entire lifetime. If we don't say, okay, I see you, I hear you, I feel you. What are you trying to tell me? Your second takeaway is, to talk to someone. So feeling those feelings, but then also sharing them with someone, whether it's a peer who's also gone through a similar loss, or a professional, or possibly, for a lot of our guys in the work, they found some solace, some comfort in their faith community or in their people that they share spiritual practices with. For you, that spiritual practice has been really about connecting in nature to something larger than yourself and getting that sense of, the interconnectivity of it all that helps you feel less alone. So what a great and powerful way to shape this conversation for all of those, particularly men who might be just struggling with trying to understand what it means to lose someone they love so much to suicide. And I'm, again, so grateful for your book, for your authenticity, for your tremendous talent. Clearly, Sebastian, you have a very good gift with words, and with expressing your experiences in a way that's very relatable, not scary, not intimidating, but I can see how you can really help people start to move forward in their grief process around that. So thanks for being on our show today.
Well, Sally, thank you so much for having me. That was an awesome recap. I was like, yeah, this, you said it so well. So
it's one of my favorite things to do on the show.
Yeah, and I just want to say, I so appreciate the work that you're doing, and it's, you know, incredible resources that you're offering, especially for a lot of different populations, but especially for men. So keep on doing what you're doing. Very important work.
Thanks. So again, thanks to Sebastian. Thanks to all the listeners who came up today. Sebastian, where can people find you if they want to learn more about your book or booking you as a speaker or as a coach?
Yes, indeed. So I have a couple websites, sebastiansloven.com, and you can find information about the book there. The book's also available on Amazon and all other book platforms. Also, if you're interested in more about Nature Unplugged, the website is natureunplugged.com.
Great. Thank you. And I hope that you're able to join us at the American Association of Suicidology Conference in Denver next spring, so that we can actually get to meet face-to-face and hopefully lift up some of your work into some key areas of people who are thinking about this kind of stuff all the time. For the listeners, if you got benefit from this episode, I hope that you tune in for more. You can find our podcast in three places if you haven't already. So SallySpencerThomas.com is where I host all of our past episodes, along with some pretty significant show notes. So if you want to dig deeper into some of the resources that come out in these podcasts, that's the place to go get them. We're also on iTunes. And so if you're listening to us through iTunes, I would please ask you to subscribe and leave a rating and review. I would be very grateful for you to do that, because that's how the algorithms of iTunes help lead people to these conversations. So it really helps us out a lot if you do that, leaving a rating, a review, and subscribing on the iTunes channel of Hope Illuminated Podcast. And then we're also on Blog Talk Radio, so you can find us there as well. And please go to the website, SallySpencerThomas.com, sign up for our newsletter so you can hear about the upcoming podcasts that are coming down the pike. I'm now up in my game to doing two a month. I know that doesn't sound like a lot to those professional podcasters, but for me, it's a lot, and I'm loving it. So twice a month you'll hear these podcasts come out. And so if you want to know what's coming, please sign up for the newsletter. I also do monthly Twitter chats that are a ton of fun and that I invite you to join into, hashtag Elevate the Convo. And then, of course, the work of United Suicide Survivors International is a big part of my passion projects. These are where we're lifting up the voices of lived experience, whether it's loss, attempts, people who are living with thoughts and feelings of suicide, their friends and family, lifting up those stories and also leveraging them for systems and cultural change. And we have a monthly webinar that you can tune into to learn more about that. So all of that you can get from the monthly newsletter and hopefully stay connected. So in closing, let me close with the final motto. Sebastian, do you have any additional final words that you'd like to say?
I'll just say very quickly that, you know, just encouraging folks to get out and share your experiences, share your stories, like we talked about. And then I think on the flip side of that, though, that's going to require some, you know, deep listening, but, you know, for those of us listening too. So more sharing, more listening. And, that's just what I wanted to leave with.
I want to put a footnote to that, because that's a very important point. You know, both Sebastian and I have been talking this whole hour about the importance of storytelling and testimonials and how important that is. But I don't want to lose track of the fact that telling stories around suicide, is daunting. It's intense. There are ways that are more helpful to the storyteller and to the listener, and there are ways that are less helpful to the storyteller and the listener. And so it's important to take time to learn how to tell those stories, make sure it's the right time for you, and make sure that you're surrounded by support and some coaching on how to do that in the most safe and effective way for you and for other people in your story and who are listening. So all of this is an important, critical part of our suicide prevention efforts, but we also need to do it thoughtfully, carefully and effectively. So thanks for that reminder. So now the closing model, open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.
Summer clearance event is here, and it's time to get to work. And working hard will build you a reputation, something that the all-new 2019 Ram 1500 prides itself on, too. You'll see it for yourself with the largest available touchscreen in its class. Hurry into the Ram Summer clearance event for a great deal and get up to 6 months of Apple Music on us.
Class based on light duty pickups. Visit www.ramtrucks.com/apple for details. Apple is a registered trademark of Apple Inc. Apple is not a sponsor of this promotion. Ram is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
This is New York firefighter Rafael Poirier. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase.